Blog Talk Radio.
And now, broadcasting from the banks of the historic Vermilion River, amidst the rolling prairie, cornfields, and unsightly wind farms of central Illinois, it's the Rhino Hour of Power. With your host, Rick Moran. Like Diogenes without a lantern. And welcome everyone to the Rhino Hour of Power. I'm your host, Rick Moran, and I got to catch my breath. Been having a runaround day today and just made it back to the microphone before the show started. At any rate, joining me tonight in the second chair is my good friend and colleague from the American Beggar, Rich Bear. Rich, how you doing?
I'm doing okay, Rick. Nice to be back.
As is our custom, we spend the first 30 seconds talking about Chicago sports. Should we talk about Chicago sports or should we just move on? Bulls have lost 6 of 8. The Blackhawks have hit a trough after playing very, very well earlier in the year. Both teams played very, very well earlier in the year, but now both teams seem to have hit a slump.
But the Bears have hired a coach who's taken his team to the playoffs 4 straight years.
Yes, but he's never won a Super Bowl, has he? they couldn't do that, could they? No, he was in a Super Bowl. He was in with Carolina.
But, well, that's because he only had Manning to work with. He didn't have a real first-rate quarterback like Jay Cutler.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. So we will hope and pray that the fortunes of our beloveds, as I like to call the Bears, turn around. We're here tonight, Richard, on the cusp of the State of the Union speech, perhaps the most useless Washington-centric tradition in America today. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I think the audience will be significantly smaller than the audience who tuned in for the Seattle Seahawk-Green Bay Packer game. And that's a good thing, yeah, because that was an exciting game, and this will not be an exciting night.
No, it is entirely predictable. In fact, I'm bipartisan in my hatred of State of the Union speeches.
Mm-hmm.
They get up there. They it's stage managed beautifully. They have standing ovations by the party that the president is attached to. They have laughter on part of the opposition at appropriate places. But the entire exercise is one of futility because the president will name off, 15, 20, 25 programs that he wants to see the Congress pass. Mm-hmm. And if you take a look over the years at every single State of the Union speech given by presidents going back, to Reagan, has 0.1% of those proposals been enacted by Congress?
Yeah. I mean, the thing that is occasionally different from one to the other is that relative emphasis of domestic and foreign initiatives that the president offers. Clearly, during the after 9/11, the first couple of years of the Bush administration, the State of the Union took on much more of have a foreign policy, war on terrorism theme, whereas with Obama, it was really interested more in withdrawing from the world other than giving a warm embrace to Islam, with all of its components except those that are not Islam, which means those who are Muslim but don't essentially do the things that Muslims are supposed to do, which is be peaceful. Other than that, Obama really doesn't have much of a foreign policy other than to withdraw. So this will be building the middle class out, acknowledging all the progress that's been made under his leadership, a couple of bones to make it seem like he's into bipartisanship. If the Republicans will only reach out a hand to him as he's been reaching out to them all these years and being snubbed, this is predictable. I mean, he's given 6 of these, and his modus of operations is not terribly hard to figure. Plus, they release the transcript, so all you really get are the hand movements and the intonation. But you can just read these things online if you want to save an hour and, you know, watch ESPN, which is what the president does most of the time anyway. He admits he prefers to watch ESPN to watching cable news. So Americans should tune out the same way. And if it's interested, it can read the transcript. They even have the transcript of the Republican response. So everything's
I don't think I've even watched a speech of his since 2011. I've read them. I've read... I'll get up in the morning and read them and then write about them in American Thinker, but I never watch them.
Yeah, I can't watch them. I mean, it's painful. Not that, again, other presidents have made these, like you say, particularly interesting or compelling television. So, but this is, I find him more annoying, in part because ideologically, obviously, I'm on the other side, but because... the level of dishonesty just seems so front and center.
Yeah.
I mean, this is a guy who loathes Republicans. So any kind of reaching across the aisle, you know, building bridges, making these last 2 years effective so, you know, America can strengthen its middle class, always the middle class, even if every initiative is really designed to help people who are poor, that can never be mentioned. It has to be striving to build the middle class because that's more politically palatable and it's a larger group.
Yeah.
And if people are going to tax A to support B, they'd rather B be the middle class than the poor.
Yeah, that's for sure. You know, one of the only dramatic moments, or if you want to call it that, in the past anyway, has been when the president looks up to the balcony where his lovely wife will be sitting, and next to her will be sitting an illegal alien. You want to talk about Obama throwing dirt in the Republicans' face, taunting them openly, and totally ignoring the results of a landslide, a wave election. This kind of thing is just mind-boggling.
Yeah,
any president who calls himself president would be so partisan about it. I mean, it's just nuts.
I assume this illegal is a dreamer because that makes you a better illegal. But the this is a president who seems to really enjoy getting under the skin of Republicans, sort of like people who troll websites and see an ability to waste a lot of people's time by saying something inflammatory, which will require a response from 20 people back and forth for the next hour of their lives. And he's really good at this. I mean, he will, I think, not so much, you know, during these 2 hours tonight where people show a, you know, degree of politeness and respect, but in the, you know, days and weeks to come, I mean, the expectation will be that Republicans will be angry, and an angry party is not as attractive as one that looks like it's being constructive and offering up their own initiatives, which is not what will go on here. I mean, this is sort of the start of the next war between the parties. You know, the relative level of leverage and strength of the two parties has changed since the election, and Obama has decided that he is just going to be more of a warrior as a result of losing the elections. I mean, he has done a wonderful job of shrinking the Democratic Party at all levels, governors, state legislators, members of the House, members of the Senate. The only guy who survived is Obama, and his margin disintegrated by 5 million between 2008 and 2012. I mean, he's the best thing that's ever happened to the Republicans, who were a party people thought were, you know, on the verge of oblivion after 2008. So all he really has left at this point is sort of to take that personal antagonism he has towards conservatives, Tea Party, Republicans, whites, I think, to some extent, and just annoy them.
Yeah. What do you think of the notion that a lot of the proposals he'll be making tonight are going to end up in Hillary's 2016 platform if she runs.
Yeah, I don't feel totally comfortable trying to speculate about the relationship between those two because it's complicated. It obviously involves Bill Clinton as well, and I don't know who has leverage and pictures on who at this point. That was always a line I learned from my old boss when I first got out of business school. He couldn't understand why a certain chief financial officer still had a job, and he said finally came to him that the CFO had pictures of the CEO. And I think there's that sort of works to explain the inexplicable in terms of how certain politicians behave towards each other. But I think, you know, both Clinton and Obama have sort of O2s and do-froms. And I don't think Hillary is a personal favorite of Obama. You could see the sort of the coldness, you know, during that 2008 campaign for the nomination. She was the loyal trooper for 4 years. You know, Bill and Hillary both spoke at the convention in 2012, gave Obama a boost, you know, to put him in the lead against Romney.
Bill Clinton thinks he won the election for him, you know, that speech.
Yeah. And if 2016 were a horse race of any kind for the Democratic nomination, I don't think Hillary would be Obama's first choice. She doesn't seem to be on the surface as ideological. There's obviously some lack of comfort between the two because they were rivals, and he aced her out. He won. He's been president for two terms. She hasn't done squat yet. So, but nonetheless, I think rather than set up Hillary, I think what's going on here is more just positioning himself so he doesn't look like a loser after the elections, but somebody firmly in charge. I think his agenda is always Obama first, and if there are side beneficiaries, it's not always planned.
Yeah, I think that's been pretty evident throughout his entire presidency. He doesn't meet with the cabinet. He doesn't give the cabinet much of a role of anything at all in policymaking, or he doesn't listen to them, that's for sure. If he had, he might have ended up in Paris. Well, then, of course, Kerry didn't know what he was doing either. Let's look at the job approval numbers of this president, because very interesting. He hit a nadir back in October when he was at 57% disapproval, 39% approval. He actually came back up, and I've got it right here in December. Where are you? To 44% approval. I'm sorry. November he was 51%. No, where? I'm sorry. This is so hard to read.
He's now at
50% disapproved, 44% approved. But he was up to like 40. The numbers were like 47 approved, 42 disapproved at one point in late December. And then, of course, the terrorist attacks happened in France, and people remembered, hey, we really need a president. we really need somebody to be president of the United States. And I think foreign policy, and every 4 years we say, oh, foreign policy is going to play a big role. I think this year it is going to play a larger role because of ISIS, because of Iraq and Syria, because of what might happen in Israel and between Israel and Hezbollah, which they might be at war in the next 48 hours. We never know.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think the American people really have rejected the administration's sort of what they regard as sort of naive reading about what the threat to America is. I don't think they view it as a couple of isolated people who have just gone rogue from what otherwise is not a threat to the United States. Islamic radicalism is not a threat. And I think most Americans reject that. The response to the movie American Sniper this weekend may to some extent have benefited from essentially what happened in the last week or 2 weeks. That you know, that American attitude and that American presence and involvement and an effort to fight this is something that people do understand. And sort of waving it away and apologizing after the fact and saying, yeah, we maybe should have sent, you know, Joe Biden or something, that's not what people are expecting. They're expecting somebody to take it seriously. And there's no evidence at this point, I think, that Obama does take this seriously. He's got a narrative to defend. He's had that since he took office. And, you know, he's been smacked around a few times. I mean, he doesn't have the ability to control the agenda on foreign policy as he does on domestic issues. With domestic issues, he has the media, you know, in his back. He's got a whole cavalry of liberal writers who are going to immediately support anything he does, any news release or information or regulation that comes down from the administration. But foreign affairs has been his undoing the last few months. The Ebola situation, in terms of the number of cases in the United States, was not significant, but there was still an aura of incompetence and bureaucratic bungling. And that was damaging to the president and his party. And I think this, you know, fiasco about whether going to Paris or not, you know, I think he blew it off to watch the football games. He just couldn't be bothered. But the security and all the other things could have been arranged if he had an intention or he thought that was an important thing to do. That matters less, his appearance, than essentially what you're offering up as a response and whether you think this is the continuing problem or just a series of isolated incidents. And I think he's distanced from the majority of the American population on the seriousness of the threat.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely correct. And that leads us into my excellent guest for this evening, the Washington editor for PJ Media, my good friend, the lovely, the talented Bridget Johnson. Bridget, hello.
Good evening. How are you guys doing?
Doing good.
Oh, I just I'm pins and needles waiting for that State of the Union address, Bridget. I'm just so excited. Can't help
suspense,
myself.
The suspense.
Yeah.
While we are on the show, I will sometime get the full speech embargoed into my box, so I will get to see the steaming pile before it goes on. We've already seen
pile.
Excerpts of the steaming pile. So.
Yes, thank you for passing that around.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the response, the Republican response. Interesting choice. Freshman Senator Joni Ernst. The first, I'm told, even though Tammy Duckworth, well, she's not a senator, is she? No. She's the first female combat veteran to serve in the United States Senate. I didn't know that. She's also a colorful, good communicator, not Reagan-esque, but she's probably going to outdo Bobby Jindal, let's put it that way, which is not hard to do in the Republican response. Why did they choose her, Bridget?
Kind of the same reason why Mitch McConnell decided to make Mike Lee his advisor this year. They're making a conscious decision, especially with the freshmen who were elected on a Tea Party agenda, to make sure that there is not a block that forms on the right that's going to coalesce against the GOP agenda as it moves forward. So they've made a concerted effort to kind of draw out some of the faces and kind of put them in a mainstream light, if you will, you know, from Mike Lee being McConnell's new best buddy to putting Joni Ernst out there front and center. They also want to, of course, pull out a woman to speak in front of the nation, but you know, I think it's going to be more on the personality of her delivery that she can make an impact rather than the content of what I'm looking at now. The GOP has a problem with their responses in that they answer vague platitudes with vague platitudes. So.
Yeah. But that's State of the Union, what that's what the State of the Union is. I mean, it's a bunch of a steaming pile of crap. I mean, Rich and I were talking about it. It's a laundry list. The president goes up there, and for 45 minutes or an hour, depending on how many times his speech is interrupted by applause, he just lists all these fantastical ideas he has about free community college. Yeah, free. What, they go outside and behind the White House and pick money off a tree? Is that why a tree? You know?
The line from that movie Dave, where they're like, this is the definition of modern leadership. You put out ideas and you don't see how you're going to pay for them.
That's right. Well, he knows how he's going to pay for it. Tax trust funds. Ooh, evil, evil trust fund babies. Ooh. Except the problem is, and I did a little research on this. There's not much research on trust funds, by the way, surprisingly. But the median amount in a trust fund in the United States is about $285,000. In other words, 50% of trust funds are less than $285,000. And when you consider that these are mostly small businessmen and entrepreneurs who spend their entire lives building up this trust fund for their kids so their kids have a better life than they did and have a leg up going into their adulthood, taxing it at 28% is outrageous. It's morally repugnant is what it is. I mean, you know, tax trust funds over $1 million. Let's do that. Let's leave the ones under $1 million alone, shall we? Now, he's not going to raise as much money, but you know what? It just makes a lot more sense that way to me anyway. I don't know.
Can you just imagine right now, though, Obama going, please, Yemen, don't fall. Not yet. Wait an hour and a half.
Yeah, to the Houthis, another Shiite state in the Middle East. Wouldn't that be grand? Oh, boy.
I know, it's like everything bad that has happened in the world in the past couple days has Iran's nasty little fingers on it. It's on the Houthis. It's on the assassination called suicide in Argentina. And yet he's going to get up there tonight, and he's going to be berating Democrats and Republicans for wanting to put sanctions on Iran.
Yeah,
undermining his authority.
To this, the idea that this was not a suicide, that's it. You're going to have to prove to me that somebody could get by 10 guards, get up to the 13th floor, go through a locked door, shoot the guy, and then come out the locked door, leaving the key in the door on the other side of the door, and then getting by the 10 guards again. Huh? Oh, you say the guards, okay. If the guards are bought off, okay, I'll buy it. But there's no evidence of that. This as coincidental
and there was no gunshot residue in his hand.
Well, again, you're going to have to prove to me that somebody could get by the guards and get into the apartment on the 13th floor. They certainly didn't come through the window. Anyway, I had a knockdown drag out.
He was about to accuse the government. You know, I don't know. I've been covering the AMIA bombing for many years, and it's just.
Yes.
So I know this prosecutor, and he was just too impassioned about his work and what he was doing to kill himself.
It was also a botched investigation. You've got to, the physical evidence was botched, according to the FBI. So it's not a subject for the evening, but I just thought I'd bring that up because everybody's saying, oh, it was a murder. Well, tell me how it was a murder. Don't just say it was a murder because of the coincidence, because of the coincidence of everything, he was going to testify, it was this and that and everything else. Prove to me that it's a murder.
The best evidence that there would be a murder is simply that Christine Kirchner is heading the Argentine government at this point. And I think she's capable of pretty much any horrific thing you can think of. So.
Okay, well,
a bad lady.
That's the problem. That's the problem with people who are saying it's a murder. They don't have any evidence. All they have is accusations. Okay, so, by the way, Bridget, you're on with Rich Baer of The American Thinker.
Hi, Rich.
Hey, how are you?
Rich, you might want to ask Bridget a non-Nisman question.
Well, actually, that was where I wanted to go because she's been studying this, which is what do you think the likelihood is that this is a result of something that involved collusion with the Argentine government, even if they kept some distance and try to keep their hands at least visibly clean from any particular action.
Yeah, I think that there could be a number of scenarios here in either Iran in collusion with the Argentine government, or the Argentine government on its own. The Argentine mm-hmm. government, because they were about to get exposed the next day in a congressional hearing. Iran colluding with the Argentine government for the same reason. And that way Kirchner could go out and say, oh, my goodness, suicide, so horrible. Oh, you know, this is just totally bad. And Iran on its own, Iran has a history of going and hitting at their opponents mm-hmm. in foreign countries, especially when they're able to go in, shall we say, without much detection or with permission from the governing power in that country.
Mm-hmm. Well, okay, whatever.
You're outnumbered, Rick, 2-1.
I'm one of those people... I'm just one of those people who prefers evidence to assumptions, that's all. Anyway,
it's rolling
okay.
in. There was no gunpowder residue on his hand.
Who said?
That came in the autopsy today.
That's the
it
government autopsy.
CNN.
It's the government
CNN.
Autopsy. Why should we trust anything the government of Argentina does? You're willing to trust them on this, but when it comes to anything else, no, you're not willing to trust them. So make up your mind. Do we trust the government of Argentina or don't we?
Just there was no reason,
yes.
no reason for this for him to kill himself. There was
no. We don't know that.
Especially when he, yeah.
We don't
know
that.
Well, we know that he was about to offer testimony, or essentially follow through on something that had been in the works that he'd been involved in for years. Would it make sense
passion
that he would cut himself short?
Yeah.
Well, then all that evidence still exists, and somebody else is going to present it.
We hope.
I mean, if that's
unless
true.
They're scared off.
So, well, okay, that's possible, but I'm just saying that they'd have to start killing everybody. I don't know. I've seen too many. There are too many coincidences in history not to see this as a coincidence. First, as a coincidence. Yes, all these things line up very nicely for Kirchner and the Iranians. But first you need evidence, and then you look to history and you see other coincidences. Oswald and Kennedy in Dealey Plaza on November 21st, 1963. How unlikely was that? That was an incredible coincidence. The coincidence that saw Gabriela Princip murder the Archduke Ferdinand. That was an incredible coincidence. Princip was coming out of a deli with a sandwich. The car of the Archduke made a wrong turn and ended up in a cul-de-sac right where the deli was, and not 5 feet away from Gabriela Princip. That is a coincidence, unless you think the driver was...
There'd been a previous assassination attempt on him, which had missed.
In the motorcade.
Result,
in the motorcade. The
motorcade shifted because they thought that they couldn't go on the prescribed course anymore because it was likely there'd be more people trying to kill him.
Yeah, actually, the Archduke wanted to go to the hospital and visit those injured. The bomb actually bounced off the hood of his car over his head into the car behind him, which contained a lot of press people. So he wanted to go to the hospital. His driver was not familiar with Sarajevo. He made a wrong turn, and Princip, who chickened out on the motorcade route, ended up despondent, eating a sandwich, coming out of the deli. And not 5 feet away from him was the Archduke's open car with his wife and him just sitting there.
Well,
now, you tell me if that isn't a coincidence. The Kennedy assassination conspiracy theorists, if they were to apply their logic to this incident, would say, oh, well, the driver was obviously in on the conspiracy. And they'd even say, well, the Archduke had to be in the conspiracy in his own assassination because he was the one who gave the order to go to the hospital. I mean,
well, there is
history is full of coincidences, people.
Well, remember that Princip had something to eat. And if I remember correctly, Oswald actually ran into the lunchroom first, so it wouldn't look like he was just running down the stairs continually to exit the building. So both of them wanted to have an appetite before they were arrested or shot.
Oswald actually had a chicken lunch, a paper bag lunch, while he was waiting for the voter case. He did. It was a chicken, fried chicken in a paper bag. So go figure. Anyway, so we can get back now to the State of the Union, right? Good.
This is more interesting, actually.
It is more interesting. It's a hell of a lot more fun, too. Going through all the coincidences in history. Here's a coincidence. How about somebody in the Union Army right before Sharpsburg or Antietam finding the general orders of Robert E. Lee wrapped up in three cigars. How about that for a coincidence? Found it right on the ground. And what's his name? McClellan had Lee's plan 48 hours before the battle. I mean, you can just look. You go through history, and there are all sorts of coincidences. And you can say, "Well, this absolutely proves that Kirchner was behind it." No, it doesn't. Sorry, you have coincidence to deal with.
But see, if you take the death of Naismann out of it, the entire bombing of the Jewish Center has turned out to be a years-long tangled web conspiracy. It's not like Niesman's death as a conspiracy would be a one-off.
Yeah.
It would just be part of
I agree with that. There's no doubt there was a cover-up. Nestor Kirchner, who was the president, before Christina, she's his widow. Nestor Kirchner, no doubt, tried to cover up Iranian involvement. Would not give the FBI access to a lot of files. Certainly, the physical evidence was denied the FBI. They had to base a lot of their assumptions on interviews, and they came up with the right culprit, a Hezbollah operative who was suicide bombing, killed all those people. And to top it off, there's a plaque in southern Lebanon. With this guy's name and his date of death as a martyr, the date of death is the same date as the bombing of the Jewish Center. So I say that's pretty compelling evidence right there that Hezbollah was behind it. But Kirchner, there's no doubt she doesn't want this to come out.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm just saying, there may be another explanation, and to dismiss it, simply because all the ducks line up in a row so very nicely, is, I think, incorrect. You can't do it. You need evidence. So let's wait for the evidence.
I'm going to go on the record, Rick, and I should be allowed to do this because someone, in response to my article on American Thinker about responding to the hit piece on Jeb Bush and Tenet, where I responded to try to defend Jeb Bush a little bit, referred to me as another stinking rhino in the Rick Moran mode, that I have therefore earned the right to say that the likelihood that neither Christine Kirchner or the Iranians were involved in what happened to this guy is about the same likelihood that a descendant of Gavrilo Princip was involved in the...
Yes, you were in the right to say that.
Okay.
And you'll look very, very silly if it comes out otherwise. Okay. We have to get back to this.
I have a conspiracy, non-conspiracy that's linked to the State of the Union.
Uh-huh.
Okay, so you know that story came out last week in the New York Times about the Senate Democrats' little coffee klatch retreat where Obama was lecturing them all about undermining my authority on Iran sanctions and blah, 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 and you know, you're just doing this for donors. And Robert Menendez got upset, and he stood up and said he was personally offended. And they got into a little tiff about it. Well, wouldn't you know, a story comes out in Politico that says that Robert Menendez has bills. You know, he has, like, some legal fees that he needs to pay. And then Trita Parsi, from the Iran-linked lobbyists in town, starts passing around the story and says, oh, it looks like he needs money from Jewish donors.
Parsi, what a piece of work.
Yeah.
Doing the bidding of the Iranian government in America. That's just, well, it's frightening to think he can operate so openly. He should be in jail for being a spy.
Yeah,
he's done some incredible things.
kind of Lon said too, when Menendez really started this, you know, battle against the White House in earnest, like, you know, over a year ago, I was like, okay, if there's some scandal that comes out of Menendez right now, I'm totally going to believe that the White House cooked it up. Mm-hmm. Because they just want him to shut up on Iran.
They probably got pictures of him with Dinesh D'Souza.
Except Menendez is single and he can get away with it.
Well, Menendez doesn't need any help with scandals. He is one. I mean, he took all those private plane rides to exotic locations on that guy's dime. His name escapes me at the moment. A doctor. And he's still being investigated for that. So, you know, he might end up being indicted for that. You never. Anyway. The Iran sanctions thing.
I think the comment he made to Menendez, though, is one that was not simply obnoxious to Menendez, but to a lot of Democrats who have sort of lined up in the pro-Iran sanctions camp, thinking that sanctions are the only leverage we had that seemed to bring them to the negotiating table to begin with, but now they're this grave threat to continuing with a process which seems to be just an inevitable series of P5 plus one concessions in desperation to get the Iranians to agree to some deal that will extend by 2 weeks the period for their breakout from what it otherwise would have been. And I think, you know, people like Elliot Engel, the congressman from the Bronx, you know, there are a fair number of still fairly solid pro-Israel Democrats who are not thrilled to be accused in kind of a Walt Mearsheimer fashion of only supporting Israel because of the money they get from Jewish donors. There hasn't been a Republican senator elected in New Jersey in decades. If Menendez didn't get a dollar from Jewish donors, he'd win re-election. And that's true for a fairly large number of Democrats who typically vote on, in what would be considered a pro-Israel fashion. So that's really below the belt type stuff. I have an article on Israel Hayom on that tomorrow. And it reflects, I think, a comfort that you can say things now, like Tom Friedman does, that Congress is bought and paid for by the pro-Israel lobby and by the Israeli government, and these guys don't have an independent thinking bone in their body anymore. That kind of stuff would have been out of bounds 10 years ago. It's not now. And, you know, Obama's kind of signaling the next 2 years, he doesn't have to worry about any more elections. He can sort of let it hang out what he thinks. And I don't think there's been any doubt for some time that he really is not a big fan of Israel and would be very thrilled to make Israel the same partisan issue that everything else is. He doesn't like that there's actually a bipartisan issue where Republicans and Democrats don't automatically line up against each other. And he's happy to throw poison into that well and try to push the Democrats to reflect more the views of the left, which, you know, is clearly in the pro-Palestinian camp. So I think this was, he looked for an opportunity to say something like this. If it hadn't been Menendez, it might have been somebody else at a different time. But this is kind of a line he's going to be pushing going forward, that American interest, national interest, is not the same as that pushed by a pro-Israel lobby controlled by, you know, wealthy Jewish donors. That's a really toxic message, but it's one he's trying to deliver.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, I made mention, I believe it was last weekend, that there's a sea change underway in Europe as well on the rhetoric. Right. It's not just the United States.
Yeah.
You know, you see, it's eerily like pre-World War II Europe in many respects. Not quite the open, nauseating type of, you know, anti-Semitic rhetoric and editorials, but there is certainly blame for Israel. There's the talk of the bankers, so it's not surprising that the primary Jewish organization in Europe would petition the EU for their members to carry guns.
Mm-hmm. I mean, they didn't, if they had done that pre-World War II, who knows what would have happened. But, mm-hmm. you know, here you are, and that's what they're trying to do.
No, I agree. Yeah, no, it's clearly it's a different situation in the United States. I mean, there is more security now than there used to be outside some Jewish institutions here. But it's not as prevalent, it's not as intrusive as what you now have in Europe. My view is that had the attack at the kosher supermarket not occurred within a couple of days of the attack on the Charlie Hebdo journalists, cartoonists, and not been associated with it in the public mind because the guy who was involved in that had also killed a policeman a couple of days earlier, the kosher supermarket would have been a one-day story. I mean, the French president didn't want Netanyahu to show up because he wanted this to be all about France and its values, not about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict or anything that was sort of tangential to a way to show love and support for Mother France.
It's always like Netanyahu for the win because he shows up and he's waving to people who are waving at him from balconies, and Alon has to go with him to the synagogue and mm-hmm. you know, huge cheers for Bibi there.
Hugging, marching arm in arm with the president of Mali, you know, an Islamic Republic in Africa.
I mean, yeah.
That had to go down well.
Yeah. you know, as far as what's going to happen in Congress, though, I mean, like you point out with Engel and you know, other Democrats like Schumer and Cardin, I mean, these are not, you know, low-level guys in Congress. These are some
right.
really powerful Democrats. That
I don't think Schumer liked it one bit.
Oh, no. Oh, my goodness. I can just imagine what was going on in Chuck's inner monologue at that moment.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and Durbin. Durbin's another one. And the fact is that, you know, Obama knows that there's a veto-proof majority
mm-hmm.
for Menendez-Kirk right now. There was a veto. There was probably a veto-proof majority in the last Congress when there weren't as many Republicans,
mm-hmm.
and that's why they pressured Harry Reid to not bring it to the floor.
Mm-hmm.
So I think when I watch this tonight, it's just going to take all I've got to just not be screaming at the television when Obama starts these scolding over Iran, because it's going to sound like a petulant child, and it's going to just be lecturing about how what he knows what's best, and you don't want the world to be blaming us for the failure of what Iran doesn't do.
Mm-hmm.
That's somehow weird argument. But I don't think that he understands that it doesn't put any of these lawmakers in his good graces when he's standing there and insulting them like he does on this. This
mm-hmm.
is an issue that they have very, you know, a lot of issues on the Hill lawmakers are doing, you know, just kind of what's politically expedient for them. But I can say, you know, having followed, you know, the work that Menendez and Schumer and others have done on this for so long, you know, it's a real, you know, deep, impassioned belief. You know,
mm-hmm.
they know it's an existential issue for Israel. They know
mm-hmm.
it's an existential issue eventually for us.
And for other allies we have in the region, or at least what we used to think of as allies, like Jordan and Saudi Arabia and the Emirates, you know, Bahrain, more moderate Arab countries that historically have been okay with being aligned with the United States. I mean, they're no happier about an Iranian bomb than Israel is.
Yeah. I just, the Iran legislation, it was supposed to be in the Senate Banking Committee this week to be approved, and they bumped it to next week. But it's going to come up soon. Banking Committee is actually where it got frozen last time, because it went through foreign relations just fine because Menendez was chair.
Mm-hmm.
But there was actually a good piece in commentary today, too, about, you know, one of the things that GOP is going to have to do is lean on Bob Corker a bit, because
mm-hmm.
he seems actually squishier than Menendez as the head of the Foreign Relations Committee now on the Iran sanctions. Mm-hmm. He's just kind of, well, you know, we'll see how it goes.
Well,
you know, we'll see how it goes.
Cameron was
you
working.
You guys already are not getting the updates you were promised on the negotiations. You know, you're not getting any sort of cooperation because Obama just finally says, hey, well, this is my administration's prerogative, so butt out.
Well, that brings up an email that Rich sent out to me today and to a couple other people, detailing the case that the Republicans are going to make, the case, literally, the case amendment passed in 1973 by the Congress then, which requires the executive branch to inform Congress of any agreement, even if it's not a treaty, that way we'll know exactly what's in this deal that they're trying to reach with Iran, which no doubt is going to be a terrible, awful, horrible deal, because we keep giving ground and Iran stands firm, and the more we give, the more Iran stands firm, and by the end of this exercise in futility, there's little doubt that Iran will be able to do whatever it wants with its nuclear program, including build bombs. I mean, it's a given. Iran is not going to give up the ability to enrich uranium, and as long as they have that ability, they'll be able to take it all the way to enrichment to bomb-making potential. So, you know, I think the idea here for Republicans and for Democrats, because I think there's 67 senators who would vote for sanctions if a good enough case can be made. Corker's objections, Bridget, have a lot more to do with politics and the appearance that passing sanctions would scuttle these negotiations, unquote, which wouldn't be a bad thing, of course, but which the president and the administration will accuse the Republicans of wanting war with Iran. So Corker is being, I think, prudent and cautious, and necessarily so. But I think in the end he's going to come around and the sanctions are going to be passed, and there is going to be 67, maybe even 68 senators who are going to override the veto.
I mean, Corker was one of those who was lobbied heavily by Britain's Cameron when he came to the United States, which is, and of course he said he didn't lobby anyone. He just wants to make contact with American senators and give him his own read on what's at stake here and what's involved and how close to a good deal they are that will check Iran's nuclear ambitions. And that's, if you're a Republican, it's more difficult to turn your back on Cameron at this point than it is for the flacks who masquerade as foreign policy experts in the Obama administration, like Ben Rhodes, the guy reading To Kill a Mockingbird to his one-month-old to believe his own written story of a meeting he had with someone at his house recently. Kind of remarkable degree of narcissism there. But, Cameron's different. That's that's somebody, an ally that people respect, and that's been actually, other than Australia, maybe Britain has sort of been first on the line in every American effort, in recent decades. So they get, more, I think, credibility when they speak to members of Congress than, say, Francois Hollande would, accompanied by his girlfriends and mistresses and screaming women. What did Dave Barry call him? The president, the Dumuff puppet or something like that. Dave Barry's year in review was hysterical this year. And he always has a couple things that he keeps hitting on over and over again. One of them was Hollande and his girlfriends and how this guy who looks like, a balding sportscaster at age 55, how does he do this? But in any case, Cameron has some credibility that Hollande would not. And I think that has had some effect on Corker. And it may be why it's not a bad thing for this to play out a week or 2 weeks, because you'll get some distance from that and you'll be able to sort of get his backup, at least people in his own caucus. At least that's what I'm hoping, because I think the sanctions are, in fact, the way to go, because I think we're being out-hustled, as everyone has been, by Iran for 15 years while they've been pursuing this program.
Now, this has been an interesting conversation, a lot more interesting than anything having to do with State of the Union, of course. But I did want to talk a little bit about the state of Obama's presidency. Rich and I touched up the favorable ratings for the president being at like 45% now. And he's still underwater. Excuse me. But otherwise, Bridget, would you say that the president is not very powerful at all, even in the Democratic Party? And is he a real lame duck, despite all the noise he's going to make tonight?
A lame duck as far as not being able to pass anything he wants to, or what?
Yes, I mean, you know, being able to get anything done. I should have built that caveat in there.
Well, he'll get stuff done on his own. He's not going to need Congress to do that. You know, I do want to hear how much he's going to threaten to use his pen still again. Oh, I just got his address. I'm sure it's eventful. I mean, you know, last time he was, you know, really vowing, you know, this is my year of action and I'm going to be, you know, doing whatever I can without Congress. And so I think that that is kind of his definition of the presidency now, you know, just how much he'll just, you know, do with or without Congress. So it's not going to be anything effective in terms of working with lawmakers at all.
Yeah.
I mean, it just, even the amount that he communicates or does not communicate more accurately with lawmakers is kind of unprecedented. But yeah, so I think it'll just be more ramrodding through what he wants through. So.
Yeah.
Public opinion be damned, because he is outlining his legacy now. That's what he cares about. He cares about what the Wikipedia page is going to say about him in 5 years.
So. Yeah, that's lovely. What a yeah. Great motivation, I'll tell you. Oh, boy. Rich, you know, he does have some powers, but on a lot of the State of the Union proposals he's going to make tonight, he's going to need Congress. He's going to need Congress for tax reform. What do you think the chances he's going to sign some, probably no big ticket items of the Republican agenda, but he might sign some legislation coming out of the Republican Congress?
Yeah, I think the president, if there is going to be a deal on something, the most likely one is a trade negotiation that gives some fast track authority with probably some softeners in there for the unions and the left on worker rights. That's in general a deeply unpopular cause among Democrats and the left. But I don't see that as an issue which Obama has sort of as much invested ideologically as he does with a lot of other issues. So it's a relatively easy one for him to give. Doesn't necessarily interfere with his desire for redistribution or a bunch of other things. The other thing about the State of the Union is, to the extent that he's a realist and is aware that there's not going to be a lot that he can do with Congress because they really have different visions for the country and the world, then all he's left with are his initiatives of what he's going to do alone, and that will not sell well in front of Congress and a national audience. You know, it'll sell well in the New York Times, but to kind of say that on the introduction of the new Republican majority Congress, that I'm going to stiff it to you if you don't do it my way, does not go well. And that's why I think he is playing largely small ball with the kind of things that are out there. These are poll-tested things, community college, it's going to be free, something else is going to be free. I mean, people are smart enough to realize there's nothing free, but except to those who get it, which is, you know, a targeted group. But some of those things have somewhat broader appeal. I mean, Tom Hanks wrote an op-ed about how community college changed his life. And, you know, if Tom Hanks is for something, how can you not be for it? I mean,
yeah, right. Sure, absolutely. So, you know, but when you look at President Obama, he is going to mention in passing, Bridget, in passing, oh, by the way, we've got some problems overseas, but don't worry about those. They'll take care of themselves for the most part. And by, besides, I'm on top of the situation, and you're safe. So go back to sleep. That's pretty much going to be his message, isn't it?
Right. I'm actually looking through the speech right now. I'm doing a quick search for keywords. There's no mention of Qaeda. There's no mention of Boko Haram. There's no mention of Nigeria. There's no mention of Yemen. There's one mention of Israel in talking about Iran. There's an Iran veto threat. Any other things we should look for?
ISIL. ISIL. That's what he calls ISIS. ISIL. See if there's anything
around
that.
Okay. So remember that the caliphate was formed in June? And he says, tonight I call on this Congress to show the world that we are united in this mission by passing a resolution to authorize the use of force against ISIL.
When he was resisting that authorization November and December. Great. Glad he came around.
What a cynical bastard he is. The Islamic State's like bigger than Belgium now, you know.
Yeah.
They're not receding. They're, you know, not withering. They're not, you know, crushed under the blow of our airstrikes.
He do differently if he had the oomph, if the authorization to use military force? What would he do differently? He wouldn't send troops. Wouldn't dare send troops. I mean, it's ridiculous. It's an exercise in idiocy.
Let's just keep airstriking.
Besides, if he wants to do something, he'll go ahead and do it. I mean, that's just him.
I've got to read this to you, by the way, because if you want to talk about pathos from members of Congress, here's one that says, Representative Gwen Moore's office is rallying members of Congress to join her in raising a pencil on Tuesday during Barack Obama's State of the Union address to honor the victims of the terrorist attack on the magazine Charlie Hebdo. Raise a pencil. More than 30 Democratic House members have signed on to raise a pencil during some of the speech's applause line when Obama speaks about freedom of expression. I mean, if you want to see Congress taking a firm stand and moving the needle, I can't think of any greater evidence than this. I would be proud to be a member of Congress and raise my pencil.
Yes, I'm sure you would be, Richard. Yes, that's.
The interesting part is a lot of the people who are raising their pencils are also ones who I'm sure would complain with the content of Charlie Hebdo.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And support university speech codes. You know, which.
There were some really funny cartoons in that Charlie Hebdo issue. Like when the terrorists have their little angel wings on and they're like, wait a second, where's our 70 virgins? And there's like a, you know, some naked feet and some clouds nearby and they're like, with Team Charlie, losers.
Yeah, that's, I mean, you know, I shouldn't be laughing at Larry Flint Hustler cartoons, but some of them are uproariously funny. Some of the, you know, naked Jesus. I mean, it's sacrilegious, it's blasphemous, but it's hysterically funny. I don't know. That's just me, I guess. Being an atheist, I can afford to laugh and stuff like that.
I think, too, you know, one of the things that was touching about, you know, looking through that issue, too, is that, you know, they didn't retreat into, you know, as I call it, the CNN sad music when they were talking about the attack. But they were just unloading on the terrorists, and they were, you know, even featuring some of the deceased cartoonists in cartoons, and I think in a way that they know that their colleagues would have cracked up at. So.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad we talked about the State of the Union address tonight, guys. Because we've reached the end of our hour. We did have an interesting discussion about a lot of other good stuff, though, so I'm happy you were able to join us, Bridget Johnson, the Washington editor of PJ Media, and Rich Baer, political correspondent at American Thinker. Thank you both.
All right.
All right, thanks, guys. Have fun watching it.
Yeah, all right. No, I'm not going to watch it. So join me again next week, same time, same place. Bye-bye.